California Public Radio presents Vietnam Reconsidered, Lessons from a War. On February 6th through 9th, 1983, 10 years after the signing of the Paris Peace Accords, the University of Southern California hosted a conference re-examining the Vietnam War. For 4 days, over 80 panelists and 1,000 participants reviewed and sometimes replayed the war in Vietnam. In this series of programs, California Public Radio will bring you the views of correspondents, former government officials, and scholars, as well as the voices of Vietnamese refugees and Vietnam veterans, as they reconsider the war that transformed them and their countries, as they reconsider Vietnam. Part 4, The War and the Warriors.
The Marines say the worst part of a pass from Con Chien is coming back. Corporal Edward Broderick has been in Con Chien about 2 months, and he's written a poem about it on the back of his flak jacket. What does that poem say? We can't quite make it out.
When youth was a soldier and I fought across the sea, we were young and cold hearts, a bloody savagery. Born of indignation, children of our time, we were orphans of creation and dying in our prime.
What made you write that poem?
Well, just the way things are.
The enemy had heavy machine guns, rocket launchers, and a host of Chinese communist assault machine guns. The paratroopers were in a battle to prevent their own annihilation. They fired into the trees. The enemy answered back.
What does it do to a guy when he survives all of this, as you have?
Makes you scared. It really does. I was up there the day after on the 20th talking to a sergeant that I knew. Just trying to console him. He wasn't hit that bad, but it makes you feel better to have somebody to talk to. I was talking to him when the mortar started coming in. And it's just impossible to describe how scared these guys are when the mortars were coming in and there's nothing they can do.
I'm from upstate New York, and I'd like to turn in my Bronze Star and 2 Purple Hearts. I lost my leg in Vietnam, and I'm totally opposed to this war we're carrying on over there. And Senator Buckley and Congressman James Hanley will receive my medals next week in the mail. Thank you. Captain of the Marine Corps. For Captain Roger P. Harrell, United States Marine Corps, the Distinguished Flying Cross. For Major Robert Kramer, United States Marine Corps, who also died needlessly, the Silver Star. And everything else.
Out of these, we got 4 Bronze Stars, 5 Purple Hearts, and 3 Presidential Unit Citations. I'd like to say just one thing to the people of Vietnam. God, I'm sorry.
What cannot be captured in these conference highlights is the tension which had been growing during the conference's first 2 days. In session after session, Vietnam veterans stepped to the microphone to ask questions, make statements, or bear witness to what they had experienced in Vietnam and since. On the final day of the conference, at a session devoted to the war and the veterans, we heard eloquent testimonial from panelist and participant alike. In this program, we bring you speakers from the stage and from the floor, beginning with George Swires, who was decorated for valor in Vietnam and now represents the Vietnam Veterans of America from the nation's capital.
This week, exactly 13 years have passed since I was last in California. I returned at a time and to a place where Vietnam is all that is spoken of, and there is some measure of comfort in that. But if I have learned anything in these 13 years, it is this: I'm not supposed to feel better. My friend Patrick Finnegan, a fellow activist and former grunt, often marvels at the government's willingness to permit any Vietnam veteran reaccess to America. For we brought home with us the awful and suffocating truth of that war, that lies, though they be cleverly camouflaged and neatly packaged and endorsed by presidents, are still lies, and that no lie clacked out in any MACV press release could bury deep enough the death, dishonor, and defecation that was the Vietnam War. The government was quick to discredit the living proof that evil had been done, to silence those returning veterans who hadn't already been numbed into silence. In 1971, when veterans threw their medals at the White House in protest of a war that disgusted and degraded them, the Nixon administration implied that they weren't really veterans, but actors. At Miami in 1972, when we marched on the Republican Convention, broken men, reminders of a broken faith, the same administration pointed to our freshly scrubbed non-veteran peers as shining hope that would not stain America. The message sent from national leadership and embraced by the public was clear. Vietnam veterans were malcontents, liars, wackos, losers. The die was cast for a decade's indifference to the social and economic reintegration of veterans. Hollywood, ever bizarre in its efforts to mirror life, discovered a very marketable villain. Kojak, Ironside, and the friendly folks at Hawaii 5-0 confronted crazed, heroin-addicted veterans with the regularity and enthusiasm Saturday morning heroes once dispensed with godless red savages. No grade B melodrama was complete without its standard vet. Psychotic axe-wielding rapists, every bit as insulting as another one-time creature of Hollywood's imagination, the shiftless, lazy, and wide-eyed black. The demented vet betrayal has become so casual, so commonplace. The one pictures the children of Vietnam veterans, shivering beneath their blankets and wondering if daddy will come in with a goodnight kiss or a Black and Decker chainsaw. There is a message in such stereotyping too, of course. Vietnam veterans are permanent residents of Never Never Land. They should be avoided as one would avoid lepers. And nothing they say is to be taken seriously. America needs its myths about the Vietnam War, just as it once needed the lies. We are all of us convinced, though not all will quite yet admit to it, that Vietnam was a shameful abomination. Someone should be punished for it, indeed, deserves to be stark raving mad because of it. The myth of 2.5 million walking time bombs tells us that someone, somewhere, in some way, is paying the price for our national sin. Absolution is lent to all others. We can live with Vietnam without ever having to look at it. Writing for the Atlantic Monthly, novelist Ward just noted, "The Vietnam War must be scaled down to life rather than up to myth." There is, as Just insists, a solemn duty to look this war in the face. And Vietnam veterans, through the honest and unedited recollections of their individual experience, hold a fascinating key. A detailed public autopsy on the war and what it did to America, one in which truth is not permitted to become a casualty, should be the permanent issue of Vietnam veterans. For only through a full reckoning, a demand for examination and accountability, can the war's demons be purged. In his January 1973 primetime speech announcing an end to America's longest war, Richard Nixon used the phrase "peace with honor" 5 times. With that, the dishonorable task of sweeping the war under the rug was formally begun. The 4 successive presidents have exploited the war. No one of them has had the moral courage to present a candid fireside chat entitled "Vietnam Reconsidered: Lessons from a War." The legacies of Vietnam hold hostage millions of Americans who have neither seen nor heard of that faraway land. Millions whose lives are ravished by an economy still reeling from a $1 trillion war. Millions whose faith in America is so eroded that we are as gypsies without any sense of national purpose. One day, in another faraway place, other teenaged Americans may well fight and die for a reason as criminal as our mere reluctance to discuss Vietnam. For if we do not speak of it, others will surely rewrite the script. Each of the body bags, all of the mass graves, will be reopened, and their contents will be abracadabra into a noble cause. A veteran who endures and survives the trauma of war has a moral obligation to articulate that experience to others. Not to do so is to totally abdicate one's responsibilities to the living, to the once living, and to generations yet unborn. I remember an Edgar Lee Masters poem, Silence, that I obediently memorized as a high school junior. In part, Silence concerned a conversation between a young boy and a very old, one-legged Civil War veteran. Asked by the boy how the leg was lost, the old soldier relives in his mind the horror of Gettysburg. But unwilling and unable to share with the boy that which his conscience demands, he answers instead, a bear bit it off. During 1969, a year when, for the most ambiguous of reasons, I walked the jungle mountains of someone else's country, carrying a high-velocity weapon intended to terminate the lives of those who would defend it, watching those whom I love being brutalized by the real-life spaghetti western we starred in, and realizing it, all of it, much too late, I often thought of the old soldier. I thought then, and know now, that his inability to share with the boy his profound grief, his unwillingness to recall the hows and whys of a leg ruined, then discarded like an insignificant chunk of meat, doomed the child to one day surrender a portion of his own anatomy, and perhaps his very humanity, in the trenches of France. There must come, through national discussion, a reckoning for Vietnam. And very clearly, it is the war's veterans, those with an insight born of deep personal tragedy, who must cry out the loudest. For it is mainly they, abandoned first on one front and then another, who have the capacity to return hope to the process. Whether or not it is fair to burden the veteran with such awesome baggage is a moot point. We may well be asking them to step onto an emotional merry-go-round that becomes for them and for the nation an eternal one. And the end result might best be described by dipping into Vietnam's macabre lexicon, where real estate, ideals, and human beings were routinely destroyed in order to save. But any risk is acceptable. How ironic it would be if our mere unwillingness to discuss Vietnam became the war's unpardonable sin. This time, the hearts and minds that are there to win or lose belong to Americans.
George Ewald served in Vietnam with the 1st Infantry Division. He has spoken and written articles on Agent Orange.
My name is George Ewald. I was drafted into the United States Army on September 14, 1966, my 19th birthday. The way we were trained, the Vietnamese were only considered as targets, not human beings. And this conditioning took me many years to be able to change this attitude. The highly developed technology that we used to enable us to decide who or what would live. This decision was ours, and we did what we had to in order to survive. When we went to Vietnam, all the values that we were raised with became useless. The situation was totally insane. The Vietnam War was just as if they had attempted to clean up America, and they had sent the young there to die. After all that we went through, we were nothing more than guinea pigs, the surplus of our generation. Our deaths then and our deaths now mean nothing to them. I arrived in South Vietnam on February 25th, 1967, and I was assigned to the 1st Infantry Division. The unit that I was sent to was located at the base camp in Phuc Vinh. It was B Company, 1st Battalion, 26th Infantry. I was assigned to an M60 machine gun squad. One area that we operated in was a free fire zone in Tay Ninh Province. Things that the average person would only dream about could and would happen as normal events. When I was in Vietnam, the land was in the early stages of dying. Even so, I have never seen land that had the deep, lush green color of Vietnam. You could not help but be impressed with the land. During my tour in Vietnam, we were never informed of the herbicide program that has come to be known as Agent Orange. We drank the water from the streams and the rivers, and we bathed in it. My tour was over on February 24th, 1968, during the Tet Offensive. We devastated the land, the trees, the rivers, and the people, with the final results being that Vietnam was turned into an ashtray. We will always live with what we killed in Vietnam. We will carry this on our backs forever. After returning from Vietnam, I was reassigned to Fort Hood, Texas, and discharged September 13, 1968. I turned 21 the next day. After leaving both Vietnam and the Army, my feelings were completely destroyed or burnt out. The only feeling that I had was that I had survived something horrible. I thought that I was finally safe and did not know that Vietnam's aftermath would still get me. I believe that the Army knew that the herbicides would not only punish the Vietnamese, but also us, the survivors. The stated purpose of the herbicide program was to destroy vegetation, thus making it difficult for the enemy to ambush our troops and those of our allies. Another purpose was to deny their forces much-needed food supplies. The herbicide program began in 1965 with the use of agents pink and purple. The herbicides were given names of color due to the colored bands on the barrels that they were shipped in. This enabled those that worked with the herbicides to be able to identify which herbicide they would be working with. In 1965, agents pink and purple were replaced by agents blue and white. Agent Orange was a mixture of 2,4-5-T, which contained dioxin, the deadliest chemical made by man, and 2,4-D. Agent blue contained cacodylic acid, which is a form of arsenic. And agent white was a mixture of picloram and 2,4-D, and was contaminated also with dioxin. Over 17 million gallons of the various herbicides were applied in South Vietnam. Reports began to come from Vietnam concerning the increase in miscarriages, birth defects, and people becoming ill, and of farm animals dying. These reports at first were dismissed as enemy propaganda. Scientists began to study the herbicide program and finally convinced the U.S. government to discontinue the herbicide program. But the damage had been done to South Vietnam and the people, as well as to the American personnel and their allies. The health problems that I have did not begin to appear until around 1975. At that time, I developed two skin growths. One was on the upper back portion of my right arm, and the second one was on the upper right side of my head. These growths were removed, and the diagnosis was that the growth on the arm was non-malignant, but the one on the side of my head was basal cell carcinoma. In 1979, I first heard that the herbicides were suspected of causing serious health problems in the Vietnam veterans, and then the chemicals were suspected of being able to cause birth defects. It is suspected that dioxin becomes deposited in the fatty tissue of the body and may remain dormant for many years. Once the dioxin is released, it may then begin to attack different parts of the body. The Vietnam veterans have had to resort to the largest class action lawsuit in the history of the nation. The reason for this class action lawsuit is because by law, we cannot bring suit against the military for health problems that may have been caused when one served in the armed forces. So once again, the legal system is used against the veterans. In order to try to remedy this situation, the Vietnam veterans have brought suit against the manufacturers of the herbicides. This is presently pending. Even with all this information, my claim and the claims of all the other Vietnam veterans continue to be denied. Agent Orange, which contained the dioxin, as did the Agent White, and the blue, which also had the arsenic, have caused many problems for us. United States Senator Arlen Specter held hearings in June 1981 on the problems of the Vietnam veterans and Agent Orange. At this hearing, I testified, and I met another Vietnam veteran. He showed the senator and the people his little girl. She was 18 months old and was born with no left arm. His other children have no serious health problems as the little girl does. He believes that his child's birth defects are the result of him being exposed to the herbicides while in the military in South Vietnam. He was in the bush for his tour like many others. At another hearing in Washington, a veteran told that he has five screwed up kids, one with three kidneys, another with a defective heart, one with a brain dysfunction, one with an immunological disorder, and the last with skin problems. He told the panel on Agent Orange that the VA treated him like dirt when he went there to receive help. These are the main reasons that the Vietnam veterans are demanding help for themselves and their children. We need serious research and not more political rhetoric and unkept promises. Almost, I'll be done in a minute. All right, let me just finish this off. We, the Vietnam veterans, have been lied to. We have taken all their filthy abuse, denied help, because we are the witnesses to their lousy, evil foreign policy, and we are an embarrassment to them. The blood of our generation is on their hands and will not wash away. We are not asking for pity, but only to be treated fairly and to receive the much-needed help for the health problems that may be caused from the herbicides known as Agent Orange. Thank you.
Admiral James Stockdale was the highest-ranking prisoner of war during the Vietnam War. He spent 8 years as a prisoner in what was then North Vietnam.
I came down from Stanford this morning not prepared to make a speech, and I'm really overwhelmed at what I'm hearing. I spent 10 years in Vietnam, 2 years flying fighter planes off aircraft carriers, and 8 in a dungeon. I spent my 40s in Vietnam. I was 42 when I was shot down. I was nearly 50 when I got out. But I think we had it better than these poor soldiers. I don't say that from the physical side, although that may be a factor. But we didn't take the abuse that we humans seem to heap on each other, particularly when there are issues over which we're so divided. Now, I lived in an entirely different atmosphere. I lived in a dungeon. I lived in solitary confinement. I lived in a political prison, certainly not the first one in the world. They date back to the Greeks. And my situation, I don't think, is just one that communists cook up, because the great author Cervantes had a very similar experience. I've done a lot of reading about prison, extortionist prisons, where the purpose of having you there is either to change your mind or use you or both. Now, this had a tripwire system, like all good extortionist prisons must have. There were rules that you were to obey, and some of the rules are really slanted against human nature, like never talking to another human, or tapping, or whispering. And if you're caught, that's moral justification for punishment, for having your blood circulation shut off with straps, for sticking your head down between your feet, to say nothing of a few clouts to the ears until you submit. And then you're free game to atone for this crime you committed. I've been through that more times than I'd like to think. But overall, there's really two lessons that I want to talk about today. And one is on the good side. And that has to do with the psychological state of people that go through these experiences. You got to understand that within these walls, we build a society. And we did tap. I hope I can hear. just said hi. We made our own code. We built our own society. We wrote our own laws, including laws for relief for cause of seniors who didn't measure up. And they worked. And something starts taking over a community like this at about the two-year point. I call it white magic, where somehow you become so much involved with the welfare of the man next door that you lose what we normally consider to be normal traits of survival instincts. And it really starts, you realize that this is my country, this is my family. We went in as apolitical people, most of us career aviators. We didn't believe a thing we heard in there because the Vietnamese insisted on putting it in their language. And so all of this chaos that the world was engulfed in, we missed. No, that we never had any question. No, it wasn't, we never, the virtue or the evil of the war never crossed our minds, I don't believe. I mean, we weren't the sort of people that, it just was an academic question. Here we were, they're gonna cope, we're gonna make it, we're gonna make them buckle, we're gonna stick together. Okay, after living in that condition for 4 years solitary in my case, and one man more, and 2 years in leg irons, been through that rope about 15 times, I've had my leg broken a second time. When you're with men like that, you really develop loyalties that supersede a lot of things. And so I'm telling you, the people that I was in prison with are pretty damn well off up here. Good luck, just good luck. Good people going in, good people coming out. Physical problems, lots of broken bones, lots of nerve damage in the lower arms from the ropes, sometimes requiring surgery. But by and large, not competitive in sheer misery with the stories I'm hearing, and I feel so thankful, and I can't take a minute's credit for it. It's just the man's horrible meanness to man, not only on the battlefield, but even worse back here, that really gets to me. Okay, so that's the good side. Now I want to just hit one little thing that I think was, I'll just pick one, I could think of at least a dozen errors of public policy in this mess. Not the least of which was trying to sneak into the war without explaining it or having a declaration or calling up the reserves or giving any of the signals that most wise sovereigns take the precaution to take care of. But this was a kind of, you'll think maybe this is trivial, but people were getting killed in there with me, and I knew that word was getting out. In 1966, February, I was pulled out of that cell one night. I had still on crutches. I was a stretcher case for the first couple of years in there, and taken down to meet, God, it was always bad news, but this happened to be a very big surprise, and it was a meeting with a man in civilian clothes. They never tell you his name, and he was there to pick my brains, and I was there to pick his, and we worked through an interpreter who I recognized the voice of, and he was the guy that used to give the announcements on the Voice of Vietnam, so I said, aha, this is somebody. Well, it turns out I know his name, I learned it later, Dr. Vien. He is in the government now, and he's a master propagandist. He was a medical doctor, lived in France, ran the anti-war campaign in Paris of the Vietnamese at the time of Dien Bien Phu through an interpreter, and he understood English, I could tell. We had a very interesting conversation that went along the lines of, where would I draw the line? He tried to compare me to a German army officer in World War II with Hitler. Of course, that was pretty much what you'd expect. But anyway, he said, we cannot measure up to your forces. He said, we will win this war. We will win this war on the streets of New York. You know, he was right. Well, I speak from a very peculiar constituency that only numbers 400, and I don't probably belong here, but I thank you for this time.
This is California Public Radio.